result of that, because I'm encountering people who are at the very earliest stages of entering into social media, I kind of get people before they get caught up in the bells and whistles of social media. And inordinately, at the end of every class, no matter what, I always get asked this question: how do you make money blogging? And I have, before I get asked that question, I've spent typically 4 hours taking them from being civilians to full-blown bloggers. They come in not knowing anything about blogging. They leave being able to blog. But I get asked, how do you make money blogging? At Blogging While Brown, the panels and breakout sessions that have standing room only, people sitting on the floor, are the panels about how do you make money blogging. And they're always shocked at me when I say the following. I say, if you are going to start blogging for the purpose of making money, and that's your business, is you're going to start blogging for the purpose of making money, don't blog. That blogging is the last thing you do if you want to make money. And the reason is because 9 times out of 10, people have, they have no idea how you make money online. They just guess. And most of the time, they guess the wrong thing. And you have to acknowledge that under the current business model of social media, it's ridiculously exploitive. If you're in a blog because you love it and you're having fun and this is your passion, that's one thing. But if you're going to go into it for business, it's ridiculously exploitive. And it will result in the fiery death of your dreams. And I've seen that happen. People start blogging with a lot of passion. They think they're going to throw some Google AdSense units over in their sidebar, and they're going to make the $100,000 that blogger that they wrote about in People magazine made. And then they do it for, hopefully they do it for 6 months, figure out it's not going to work, pivot and quit. The worst case scenario we'll be seeing later in here, where they don't pivot and quit, and they keep holding on just long enough until their big payday comes. The social media business model right now is that there are tens of hundreds of millions of people creating a ton of content that other people are making money off of. Mark Zuckerberg is now a billionaire. Did you get your check from Facebook? No, you did not. Twitter has however many millions of people on Twitter. Twitter is not sending you a check. Those are two obvious examples. Ad networks, which for those of you who blog, you may know about that. The agencies are making plenty of money. They're sending their kids to school. But if you think that ad units are going to pay your mortgage, that's just not going to happen. So before you go into a social media business, you need to acknowledge these inequalities in the system so that you don't become a victim of them. And so I usually use this as an example because most of these people are African American, and this tends to get people's attention and say, maybe I need to pay attention. If you do not plan out how you are going to make money online before you start blogging, you're going to end up social media sharecropping. You're going to do a whole lot of work, and somebody else is going to get very wealthy, and you won't. Most of the policy advocacy related to blacks and technology, in my opinion, fall into these four categories. How many of you have heard of the digital divide? Okay, cool, good. They did their job very well then, if you've heard of it. The digital divide was something that came out of the Clinton administration somewhere around 96-ish. And back then it was to get not just black people, but poor people, rural people, to make sure that everybody in America had a computer and had access to the internet. And that was a big push. Then I guess the modern day younger sister of digital divide would be universal broadband access. Now those same policy advocates that were talking about everybody has to have a computer and everybody has to be able to get on the internet, they're saying dial-up's not enough. You need to have a broadband line into your home, and that would be considered progress. Another area is STEM careers. And then the last is access to venture capital. And I treat that differently than other types of capital. But those are probably, if you talk about blacks and technology today, those are going to be the four categories that people are going to talk about. They're going to talk about the digital divide. They're going to talk about universal broadband access, STEM careers, and maybe they'll talk about access to venture capital. There's a problem with that. There are three types of online activity: consumption, participation, and production. Which of the three do you think the digital divide addresses? Okay. Y'all are all right. They address consumption, and they address participation and engagement. That the problem with that is the only thing you're doing, if your technology policy position is, let's create more consumers so Black folks can consume more video on a mobile phone instead of a television set, is you're not shifting inequalities. You're just moving the inequalities to a new playing field. And the distance is becoming broader. The part that gets ignored in almost all of the technology policy advocacy directed at Black people, as far as I'm concerned, is that last one, production. Consumption is passive. It doesn't create anything. In fact, I can make a very strong argument that consumption destroys things. How many of you have heard like some amazing Twitter statistics about how many Black people are on Twitter and how we disproportionately represent on Twitter? Okay, everybody's heard that. How many of you have heard that Black people disproportionately represent in the mobile market? We have more, okay, we adopt mobile technology proportionally more than white people. And that sounds, oh, awesome, the digital divide is closing. But we don't take the next step and say, okay, what are they doing with those cell phones? We're just moving them from one device to another that they're carrying around so somebody can sell them more crap, so that they can direct their time at more stupid stuff, as far as I'm concerned. And we're not addressing, and even participation and engagement, great, go vote, that's awesome. Sign this petition, that's awesome. Talk back to me, that's awesome. Is that creating wealth? Is that closing the wealth gap? No, maybe closing a knowledge gap, but it's not doing that. But the third one is production. And that's what makes bloggers special, is because bloggers are digital media content creation creators. They're creating something, and what makes them special? And blogging is a gateway to all these other types of digital media content creation. And what I mean by that is I can take someone who has no technology background whatsoever, but they're familiar with email, and they are maybe familiar with most word processing programs, and without knowing any special technical skills, they can start to distribute content to the world in a matter of, you know, minutes, maybe an hour. They'll get up to speed. And what you'll find is, I started out as a blogger. Once you start connecting with people and you start creating content, you start to want to do more and more and more. And what I've personally seen is bloggers will start out writing text, and then they'll say, hey, I want a podcast. And then they'll say, okay, maybe I want a YouTube channel. And eventually, what started out as just merely writing their, primal screen to the world, they actually end up basically having their own newspaper, television station, radio station, all of that. College-educated Black folks. Again, what is a digital divide and does it matter? College-educated Black people are more likely to create a website than their white counterparts. Did you know that? But the world tells you we're not online. The barriers to entry to blogging are low. However, just like every other Black business, you can start it, but when you decide you want to expand and do something more, that kind of special part of blogging that I like, that it's a gateway that leads to something else, that's when Black bloggers and Black digital media content creators, they face the same barriers as other Black entrepreneurs. And what do you think, if you ask Black entrepreneurs, what's the greatest barrier to Black entrepreneurship? Access to capital. It's the same thing. I think this is a study by the Kauffman Foundation, for any of you who are interested. And I like the study. It's called Financial Capital Injections Among New Black and White Business Ventures. And what I liked about it was it talked about the fact that when Black people start businesses, we don't get outside equity. We start our businesses with owner equity, which means you start your business with your own money. There's not a banker that's going to give you money. And typically, there are some more panels here at South by Southwest talking about venture capital. And the reason that's important is, because if you don't have revenue coming into your blog, how are you going to expand if everything you do is based on ownership, owner equity, or your ability to invest your own money to expand your business as opposed to someone else's money? And so in a sense, if you start blogging and you don't have any of this magical excess money coming in, you're kind of stuck. And I'll get into the dangers of getting stuck in a few slides when we talk about social media sharecropping. I did a study because everybody lies about how much bloggers make online. They do. Technorati's done some stuff. Google AdSense has done some stuff. The Black Weblog Awards has something called New Bloggers on the Block. And these are bloggers who've been blogging for less than a year, and the blogs are owned by someone who's African American. And we asked them a series of questions. What we did was we asked them questions about their favorite blog posts and about their blog and that kind of stuff. And then at the end, we asked them a series of questions about their monetization strategy. And the questions we asked them were, again, these are new bloggers blogging less than a year. They're African American. Are you attempting to generate revenue from your blog? Is blogging your full-time job? If blogging and social media is not your full-time job, do you want to be in social media full-time? And then this is an important question. In the last 3 months, I didn't do the last month because I know the way this works. In the last 3 months, how much revenue has your blog generated? Are you a member of an ad network? And if you are, what's the name of that ad network? What do you think, on average, what new bloggers make in a period of 3 months? Anybody? You say zero? Zero? Okay, I have zero. Nobody's going to say 1,000? 50 bucks? Oh, you messed up my whole thing. Dadgummit, I was hoping for round numbers. So the first question is, are you attempting to generate revenue for your blog? The top number is 17%. The bottom is 55. And I don't know how I came up with that because that doesn't make any sense. Oh, you know what? Maybe the 17 responses. But anyway, that's the difference in yes or no. Most of them do. Almost twice as many of the people who are attempting to, who answered said that they're trying to generate revenue. Blogging, is blogging your full-time job? 94% said no, which meant that 6% said yes. I'm a math genius. If blogging or social media is not your full-time job, do you want to blog or work in social media full-time? 17 of them wisely said, 17, that doesn't make any sense. 17% said no, and 45 said yes. I think that's actually, yeah, that may be raw numbers. In the last 3 months, how much revenue has your blog generated? And the choices were less than $100, $101 to $500, $501 to $1,000, and then $1,000 plus. Let's see. 86% said in 3 months they had made less than $100. 9% said $101 to $500. $501 to $1,000, there's only 1%. And then 1,000 plus, 4% of those bloggers, that's basically two respondents, and they both belong to the Glam Ad Network, if that's important to anybody. And then are you a member of the ad network? This must be raw numbers again. And the majority actually are not a member of an ad network. About 35% are, or 35 are. And then these are the ad networks that everyone's a member of. And you see Google AdSense is like more than everybody else combined. So we also asked them to give us open-ended answers about their monetization strategy or what they were thinking about as far as monetization. And I picked out some that kind of fall into broad categories that I've heard frequently. The first one is, if I build SFB and audience, the money will follow. And what she says is she started to monetize her blogs through AdSense, but she deactivated AdSense, realizing the priority is my creative writing process and building up a network of readers first. Maybe after I feel like I'm in the right position to seek any real revenues from my work, then I will proceed. The path to riches is paved with page clicks, which means that they believe that if I work hard enough to generate page clicks, then I'm automatically going to be rich. And she says, I realize that while making money with a blog is important, being strategic is even more important. I agree with her. I disagree with the following. One must be able to generate enough traffic onto their blog in order to attract enough people and make money. I disagree. I tell everybody there is no direct correlation between your ability to make money and the number of page views you get if you do it right. I have my personal blog has a relatively tiny niche audience, but it is a fairly influential audience, and anything I want, I could get. So it's not necessarily just, oh, let me just get a bunch of page clicks. And you'll find that there are gossip and entertainment bloggers that have 1,000 times more traffic than I do, and they can't necessarily extract the same value because different audiences. It's not always about scale. But the preconceived notion is that you just have big, you need a big audience in order to make money. That's not necessarily true. You need some audience, but not necessarily a big audience. And this one probably is the one, because I did a lot of red writing, I'll figure it out later. And this is where she's actually making money. She says, I'm making money because my readers want to hire me to do weddings and things like that. So she has a revenue model, but she disregards it because she thinks that she has to focus on getting revenue from ads. And that's an example of what you don't know will hurt you. She has a revenue stream that's probably a lot better than what Google AdSense is going to give her, but she wants to skip that because she thinks ads is where she should be. Okay. So we're moving on to sharecropping in the post-Civil War South, which is kind of probably why y'all came here. Everyone knows we had a big war here in the United States. Okay. Anybody not from the United States before I make too many assumptions? Okay, so we had a war that basically tore apart the fundamental underpinnings of the economic system in the South. It was an agrarian system that required a lot of work, and after slavery, they could technically no longer rely on the forced cheap labor of slaves, because technically slavery ended. And for those of you who watched PBS recently, you know that technically, I have to keep saying technically, because some people say that there was slavery by another name. So this is great. I'm free. I'm a slave. I'm free. I have no possessions. I have no land. I have nothing. I can't even read. The plantation is all I've ever known. I've never possibly been outside a certain radius. So you have the economic system that, yes, it enslaved them, but it also took care of them, and it gave them a way for their families to eat and keep a roof over their heads. But their skills were tightly linked to agriculture. They didn't own property. I said they were illiterate, but they were very dependent on their powerful landowners. And that dependency relationship, that was a mutual dependency. It wasn't just one way. Power might have been imbalanced, but the slave owners couldn't have survived without the slaves. So what happened after slavery? Basically chaos, because the whole system that you relied on, forced labor, was gone away. So sharecropping was one of the ways that we were supposed to meet this demand for labor with the supply of labor. The benefits, I guess if you could say there were some, was that freed slaves got access to land. They could support their families. Landowners were still able to take advantage of economies of scale. They didn't have to like sell off parcels of their land to individual people. They could still own everything and just hand off parts of it to be farmed. And agrarian production continues. And I just should also say that sharecropping isn't new to the States. It's been around probably since the beginning of, I guess, civilization in a sense. You can find sharecropping or tenant farming on every continent. Everybody has their own version, and it pops up in response to various, you know, country-specific things. So in theory, sound like a great solution, or, you know, the best you could do with what you had. But in practice, what often happened were that the sharecroppers had to purchase their own materials and supplies and things like that, and a predatory lending system arose. Does that sound familiar? predatory lending system arose, and the sharecroppers ended up in debt. Wealthy landowners created very onerous contracts. Anybody in social media? Anybody? Okay, yeah. Do we encounter onerous contracts at all? Like every time you sign up for any service, there's an onerous contract. Sharecroppers also couldn't determine the price of their crops. Good luck trying to figure out how much Google's selling your ad product for. And by 1900, in Mississippi, I just pulled this stat, 85% of black farmers were sharecroppers, as opposed to 36% of white farmers. So while it was promising, it had some problems. And then this is a quote that I thought you could apply to both. And he says that, in retrospect, sharecropping's a tragedy because it's associated with a kind of static, hopeless poverty and debt cycles. And it inflicted the South well into the 20th century. And I think there are lots of parallels to what's happening in social media. People say, Gina, it's not quite that tragic. I say, yeah, I think it is. Because here you have this amazing group of very creative, talented black people who are internet savvy. They are very likely to be college educated. Bloggers are 1.5 times more likely to be college educated than the general population. College educated, they have all these skills. They come into something and they're really going to do something transformative, which is to produce content. And for those of you who understand anything about black media ownership, that's pretty awesome. The digital revolution created some amazing opportunities. But year after year, I see these incredibly talented, gifted black people come into social media and blogging, and they leave. They hit a wall. And they assume that it's because it's something wrong with them. And it's actually the system is screwed up, and they never pause to ask themselves why things were the way they were and what they needed to avoid. So this is from that original survey that I talked about maybe about five slides ago. And this is this person's story. And I related it back to what he said. It's a static cycle. It's a cycle of hopelessness. This person has been blogging since 2007. What's the minimum amount of money you have to earn on Google AdSense for them to send you a check? Anybody know? You clearly did not sign up for Google AdSense. Anybody know how much you have to earn before they send you a check? It's $100. So in order for her to get a check from Google AdSense, or him, I don't know if the gender, all that they had to do was, since 2007, generate $100 in revenue. And they would have gotten a check. 2007, this was in the 2011. She is still waiting on her check from Google AdSense. And this person is not alone. There are plenty of people who think that the ad-based model is going to make them rich. And the problem with social media is that you get so much stimulation back that's non-monetary. You have people commenting. You have Twitter followers. Somebody's your Facebook fan. I want you to take that to the bank and deposit it and let me know which banker lets you do that. But in other traditional businesses, if you own a restaurant, a few times if you're wondering whether or not you're going to make payroll, at some point you're going to sit yourself down and talk about pivoting, or you're going to evaluate what you're doing. The problem with social media is that the stagnation isn't painful enough to force people to pivot. And so they end up in this same type of cycle until they burn out. Okay, I'm a little bit ahead. So we're going to go back to black online activity. If we lose black consumers, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe they're reading a book instead of playing a video game. Participation and engagement, maybe we'll suffer in civic discourse, I don't know. But every time you lose somebody who's able to produce content, you're basically closing off the opportunity, in my opinion, for self-determination. And I think that's probably a little bit more important to me than consumption. And that's why it's important for us to have honest, open conversations with people who think that they're going to make money online so that they go into it with the right mental aspect. I think I've said this before. How many of you, any of you come from other traditional forms of media? Anybody? Okay. Do you know how many commercially owned television stations we have in the U.S.? You raise your hand? No. There's about 1,379, 89, I think that's the number. How many of those are owned, those 1,300 stations are owned by black people? None? Okay, he's saying none. It's not quite that hopeless. You're saying what?
One.
Okay, y'all are a bit pessimistic in this room. Five, you're getting warmer. See, overly optimistic. That's a problem. It's about eight out of 1,300. Can we acknowledge that maybe we've been shut out of magazines? Maybe we've been shut out of publishing? Maybe we've been shut out of radio? Maybe we've been shut out of television? But here it is that every indicator is showing that college-educated blacks have grabbed on to the digital age for content production and distribution. So the one shining light in black media ownership gets almost no attention. None. It's either we're focused on trying to get people to adopt the internet so that they can become consumers, or we're focused on getting that bright, shiny, new mobile app, $2 million. But we don't pay any attention to this producing class, which to me has the ability to literally alter the course of human history, because if you control your images, you control your destiny. And that's not just in this country, that's around the world. And that's why other groups of people fight to control their images. The ability to divine our own images. If you're a black woman in this country and you turn on cable television, or no, let's say you're a Martian alien and you come from another planet and you happen to stumble upon cable television and you see women who look like me, you're going to draw certain conclusions based on that. Shall I share them with you or no? No, you would draw conclusions that we're hyper-violent she-beasts who fight over Le Boutons and Louis Vuitton, and that we want to throw champagne bottles and glasses. That is one of the dominant images of black women in this culture. And that's because we don't control our own images. And people say, yeah, but black people are producing that show. I say, yeah, but who greenlit it? And what blogging allows is for us to define who we are for ourselves, not just to complain about what we don't like, but to create the images we want to see. Digital media is so awesome as opposed to analog because the cost of content creation has gone down significantly. There was a time when you had to go to film school to make movies. You had to use certain equipment. Now, this little snazzy laptop has the same editing software that major movie studios would have. Many of your mobile phones are more powerful than computers that fill a whole room. I don't know what the new iPad camera has, but I'm sure it's really nice, you know? So, I mean, with digital, you can create content with that one machine. You can do a lot of content creation. And then this one, to me, is most important. We have the ability to move the center of content creation out of New York City and out of Los Angeles into places like Atlanta and Austin and Indiana. Because I don't have any confidence that if we're concerned about images and how we speak to the world, that the people in those entrenched systems are going to produce that change. The revolution will not be vlogged, televised. It won't be vlogged out of New York or LA. I think it's going to be somebody in Cleveland because they're not a part of the system. And so they have the ability to do something different. What happens when black bloggers have breathing room? Because this whole discussion has been about creating an online business plan that generates revenue so you have breathing room, so you're not subsisting like the sharecropper, so that every year you're not spinning your wheels and you're able to expand your platform. How many of you have heard of Black and Married with Kids? Okay, I see enthusiastic hands. If you haven't, you should check it out. They have not paid me. They do not know that I'm featuring them in this presentation. But this is a website by two married black people, and I don't know if you've heard, but apparently black marriage is extinct if you listen to all of the Washington Post studies that they like to print out or ABC Nightline, but black marriage is a hot topic and apparently we're all doomed. These two people disagree. They live in Atlanta, Georgia. They created a blog called Black and Married with Kids, and they basically say the reason we did it is we didn't like the images that were out there. But what happens when they have breathing room? Okay, so what's really, some people would be impressed by the fact that they have 100,000 Facebook followers. That is impressive. But what I'm more excited about is this, which you can't see, because I put it on a diagonal. But what that is a picture of their latest feature-length documentary production called Still Standing. This is their third. So they started off with a blog because they wanted to produce, control their own images. Now they've moved into feature documentary filmmaking, and they're bootstrapping this, which means they're paying for this themselves. This is something that would not be possible in an analog world, and I'm going to tell you why. Because that's the camera they're using. It's a DSLR. You can rent one in town for $20 a day, but they probably, whoever did, they probably owns one. I own one. They couldn't have done this in an analog world. So here you have bloggers who started out blogging, and then they had a little breathing room. They weren't just subsisting, so they were able to reinvest in their platform, and they started to create their own feature-length films. I have no doubt that in about 5 years, they are actually going to be producing fiction. To me, it's clear. I don't know if they see the vision, but I have it, so I'm telling you. They don't know it yet, but I have the film. And because, I don't know, if you go to their site, you'll notice in the side, they have a lot of stuff that's targeting children. I could easily see them moving into animated cartoons and gaming as well. But these are two people who started out as bloggers, as many bloggers do. And then this is what I'm most excited about, which you probably can't see either. At the bottom of the page, that's an Eventbrite order form. I don't know, anybody not heard about Eventbrite? It's an online, you can sell admission and tickets to events online. Basically, anybody can do it. You can create an event, sell it. Not only have they created their own documentary, their third, but they are theatrically releasing the documentary themselves. They are selling their own tickets. They have reserved their own venue. They are leveraging their 100,000 Facebook fans. This is the third time they've done this. If you're a black filmmaker, you realize how revolutionary that is. I'm excited about that because distribution is one of the log jams that we still run into. They don't know what they're not supposed to know. They don't know that they're supposed to get a distribution deal and go through someone else. Eventbrite would not exist in an analog world because it's an internet-based company. So this is what happens when black bloggers have breathing room. They go from watching Google AdSense to basically they're producing their own feature-length documentary and they're doing self-distribution. Okay. We did a survey of conference attendees, and this kind of reaffirms the fact that it's not that people aren't interested in this topic. It's not that if the resources weren't put in front of them, they wouldn't be interested. Because we asked people after the last Blogging While Brown conference, if we had like a niche event, would you be interested in? And the overwhelming majority of them, and those are raw numbers again, I can tell, I figured that out by now, is most of them are interested in monetization and sustainability. One thing that's missing from, there's like this gap when we talk about black tech adoption or blacks in technology. There's this gap. We focus on getting people on the on-ramp. These are people who are completely not connected. And then we focus on having black people succeed in Silicon Valley. But there's this huge spectrum of bootstrappers, to me, that are the heart and soul of what the digital age for the black community could be. And they're being stifled because they don't have the knowledge to move out of this cycle. And in that sense, they're very much like sharecroppers. It's just this grinding cycle and they never move out of it. So if I had to give a call to action is, if you haven't started blogging and you have business experience and business sense, and I'd encourage you not to blog. I'd encourage you to go find some bloggers who are already passionate content creators and they're very successful at it. They just don't have any business sense. And if you really want to affect change, then throw some resources at connecting these bloggers either with the entrepreneurial knowledge themselves or connecting them with partners who can help, or co-founders, whatever. I know that's, I guess, a technical word. Who can help take them to the next level. I'm done. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. You have a question? Okay. Oh, he's bringing a mic.
Charmaine Sellers.
Is it on?
Hello?
He's got to turn you up. Yes, okay. We can hear you.
All right. Hi, I'm Charmaine Sellers, and I live here in Austin as well. First, I want to tell you thanks for putting this together and sharing this information with us. And the stats that you shared were about Twitter, but do you have any on Facebook? Because I know that, you know,
I don't, but I can Google it when we leave.
Okay.
But I can tell you that black people are more frequent users of social media than other groups, than Hispanics and whites.
And a second question.
Okay.
What prompted you to start blogging? Because I read that you were an attorney. So what made you want to make that jump?
Okay. I wish that I could say that it was planned. I was watching Oprah Winfrey. And I'm a activist blogger, so I'm not blogging to sell Pampers or anything like that. But nothing wrong with that, by the way. I was watching Oprah Winfrey. This was after Don Imus referred to the Rutgers women's basketball team as nappy-headed hoes. And Oprah had a show called After Imus, Now What? And I was incredibly frustrated with the conversation that happened on the Oprah show. That there were these young women from Spelman College that were being ignored. And I said, and to me, what the lesson from Don Imus was that if you get advertisers to pull their dollars from nasty content, it disappears. Okay, there is a Rush Limbaugh exception. But back then, Don Imus actually went away for a while. And he didn't go away because he embarrassed MSNBC. He went away because American Express and other sponsors pulled dollars from that. And to me, that was the lesson of Don Imus, is that black women have a ridiculous amount of market share. I mean, we control a lot of money. And if we stop funding foolishness, then it would go away. It was a very simplistic thing. So I'm sitting there watching Oprah, eating pistachio almond ice cream, and reading a blog at the same time. And I said, somebody should start a blog about that. And somebody should organize women and get them to go after these sponsors. And so that's how I started. I thought I was going to stop after 30 days. I make 5 years on April the 18th of this year. I'm retiring, by the way. But what ended up happening was I kind of came into the blogosphere at a time. 2007 was, I want to say, it was kind of a golden age. It was just pre-Obama. And there was kind of this, What made my blog different is that my readers actually would pick up the phone. The level of engagement of my readers was higher than other blogs. They would actually pick up the phone and call advertisers and sponsors. And probably the reason most people who know my name know me is that I defunded a show on black entertainment television. And that had never been done in like their 25 years. It's a show called Hot Ghetto Mess. And I defunded it. Meaning that when they advertised their first show, there was the only ads were from like Bob Johnson's Who's Your Caddy, and I think HBO. And in all the years of black entertainment television and people complaining, nobody ever really bloodied their nose and made them reverse course. So that's the first reason why people know me. Then I've gone on to do some other stuff. But that's how I started. That's how I started blogging. And blogging literally changed my life. And so I want to do that for other people too. So that's kind of why I'm passionate about it. The mic went somewhere else. Where's the next question?
Hi, Gina.
Hello.
Sean Williams, author of Blogging While Black, which features Ms. McCauley in the book. I wanted to ask a question as someone that's, you know, in and out of sharecropping. One of the things that's frustrating is not just the access to capital, which is a really tough problem, but also within, you know, when you're having conversations within the African-American community, you know, everyone that I told I was coming by to, most of the African-Americans in Dallas, I told I was coming to South by Southwest said, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, and so these are also people that you will eventually possibly need. And so where are we as it relates to just getting the information out as a whole into the community to those of us, you know, you have to know there's a problem before you can even address the problem. And like within the community, it's like we still don't even realize that there is a problem.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to my earlier slides. The people who are controlling the policy and the advocacy conversation, those people tend to be based in Washington, D.C. And they have agendas that don't really aren't necessarily tied to improving the lives of black people who do not live in Washington, D.C. For example, there was about $300 million stimulus dollars that were aimed at broadband adoption and expansion, which meant there's about 150, 160 so that was actually to drop the hard lines that move the information in rural communities. And then there was another pot of $150 million to increase sustainable broadband adoption. And basically, that's to get people who already have their buildings and communities wired for broadband to actually use it. The $150 million. They gave $28 million of that to a consortium of civil rights organizations. I think they used it to produce a website. I think they produced an online serial soap opera called Diary of a Single Black Mother. Have anybody heard of that? That was paid for by that, and then they also did some computing centers and housing. Public housing. That's what I want to say. In public housing, and of that $28 million, I have to wonder what if a million of that went to addressing the issue of production, or just for instance, I have a nephew. Teaching parents, okay, great, you're buying all these video games because we consume a whole lot of video games. Well, there's a program called Blender 3D. It's a 3D modeling program, but it also has a game engine. So you can design your own video games. And you can teach yourself how to design these video games on YouTube. YouTube is the greatest technical university on the planet. There's nothing that someone cannot teach you on YouTube, including how to get through a TSA body scanner this week was, you know, the thing they wanted to teach. But this is a free program. I think it takes up 20 megabytes of memory on a computer, which is not anything. Now, when it starts to render, it takes up a lot of computing power, but just to download it. But this is free. And so we're not having a conversation in the African-American community because the leadership in the African-American community that's driving the discussion about blacks and technology, they are focused on the digital divide and not the digital production divide. And that's the problem, is that our resources are being directed. And I'm not saying turn away from getting black people access to computers or home broadband, but what I'm saying is you have to include a production component. There is no magic wealth creation fairy that says if you have a computer in the home, suddenly the wealth gap closes. And so that's part of it. The people driving the policy conversation just completely they're not directly impacted by the outcomes of their policy making. So that's my opinion anyway. Anybody have any? I don't know, you're smiling, so I don't know. Is it a trick question?
Well, you said, I'm Sam Robertson, Austin Alpha Foundation. One of the things I see that's key is high-speed internet. Mm. I mean, even if you don't have high-speed internet at home or at a place where you can sit down and think, you know, you're lost. I mean, you're not connected to anything that can develop or even possibly begin to develop any of that. So, I mean, there are initiatives that people say, hey, we're going to do this, and you contact them about those initiatives and, oh, we haven't decided what we're going to do yet. So until you get there, I mean, if you're from Austin.
Yeah.
You know places like St. John's and Del Valle, and those places are isolated from the standpoint of high-speed internet connection. And how do you break that? That's a key question.
Well, I think the production, and again, I think that's the problem with this conversation on a policy level in Blacks in Tech, is that you can't tell me that you wouldn't increase interest in broadband home usage if you were able to demonstrate to them that this is a wealth-building opportunity as opposed to, oh, well, why don't I need internet to watch video? I have a TV or I have an Xbox. Or even another thing is that a lot of people have very powerful computers in gaming systems. Gaming systems are pretty powerful computers. They just only exploit them for gaming, and they don't exploit them for anything else. I agree that home broadband adoption impacts the ability to produce, because if you have broadband at work and broadband at home, you just have more time, and part of the creative process is time. The problem is if you only address broadband home adoption, you don't address what people do once they've adopted it. And you're just going to shift consumers from TV to watching it on their iMac or whatever Steve Jobs' predecessors or successors come up with. You know, you're just going to move. You're just shifting. You just, you know, because kind of this whole discussion is there's nothing new under the sun, and we keep repeating the mistakes of history. That's kind of what this, I guess I could have put that in the PowerPoint. We keep repeating the mistakes of history in the Black community in particular. We keep finding ourselves in the situation where we have limited access to capital, and we kind of end up in this grinding circle. But I think we do have to lay some blame at the Black people who are making policy and who are determining what the agenda is as it relates to Blacks in technology. Everybody doesn't want to run a startup to produce 10x in 3 years. Everybody doesn't want to run Facebook, but maybe they want to run a nice little production company that cranks out one feature-length film a year and some DVDs and makes millions of dollars a year instead of billions. But we either have a discussion about Black startups, which is good. That's a good discussion. We need to have that discussion. Or how do we get internet broadband access into the home?
Yes, my name is Winston Ford. I run a blog called The Couch Sessions, and I actually am freelancing for blackenterprise.com.
Oh, cool.
Just to counterpoint to what he was saying, I think nobody's really talked about mobile tech adoption in the African-American community and the fact that, you know, now we have smartphones that are more powerful than computers maybe 5 to 10 years ago, and that's kind of driving the adoption of Twitter and Facebook, because they're all coming through mobile platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering if there's any resources that we can use to kind of capitalize on that. Maybe it's, I don't know, like some type of mobile adoption. I don't know. Any type of way we can monetize our use of mobile and our use of Twitter and Facebook and things like that on a mobile platform, and kind of maybe spread tech adoption and monetization that way instead of focusing just on home broadband or broadband at your school or broadband at, you know, a community center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think that's true. But the truth is, as awesome as mobile phones are, I think with tablets, we can definitely have a conversation about production on tablets. Mobile phones are a little bit more difficult just because of limited functionality. And actually, there's a study that I did, and she talks about, that I read, and she talks about, again, the digital divide being also a divide in what people do with their devices. So yes, Black people are overrepresenting adoption in mobile, but what they're doing with their mobile phones are not the same things as what whites are doing with their mobile phones. Am I aware of an app or something like that? No, that produces, well.
Well, I'm talking more about, hopefully, like, we realize that. Like,
yeah.
We're kind of leveraging mobile more than anybody else. Like,
yeah.
You know,
We're gonna have to craft a message about using mobile phones to produce content, and you're gonna have to hammer that message just as much as you hammer the message about using mobile phones. And kind of the point of my thing is, when you talk about the things we tend to focus on when we're messaging to people about technology. It's always a technology career, venture capital, or you need to be hooked up to the web. We then never have that extra. I just don't think we focus on production. So as far as mobile, yes, it's promising, especially when it's a stat that iPad users consume. They either consume 6 times or 12 times more content. Have 10 minutes? Okay. 6 times or 12 times more content than other device users. And to me, iPads are tablets, I guess. Although, what did they say? They're trying to, anyway. So in that, we have to add a production component to any conversation we have about adoption and leveraging technology. That's my best answer to you. I have run into some really neat mobile apps on the iPhone that people actually produce content. So maybe something you could do at Black Enterprise is write an article about how you can make money using your phone and maybe feature some of these content production apps and feature some folks who are working from their mobile phones and actually making money. Because on the mobile side, people are definitely making money with mobile advertising. There's, I've met a few people and they look like me and they're focusing on capturing the consumer on the consumer side. So that may be something when we have discussions about mobile careers, feature somebody other than the vice president of operations for Verizon. Feature some young up and coming entrepreneur, you're going to have to go search for them, who is actually generating content using a mobile device. And you know something else? You should study. I'm telling you, you should study. The Economist did, because do you realize that people in the developing world are more advanced with how they use cell phones than we are? They're using cell phones for stuff. I'm just like, you can use a cell phone for that? So if one, yeah. Like, there's a cell phone app where they can, like, take a picture of a building to determine the structural integrity of the building. Yeah. In Africa, they're doing that. So I would say there's an Economist article, there's probably several, on the use of mobile technology in the developing world, in particular various African nations. And I think that's probably a good place to start, because there probably are people who, just as a matter of course, because they never developed the wired, so they're not having this debate over broadband, they never did build out the wired parts of their infrastructure. That would probably be a good place to start, because I did remember reading an Economist article, and even the farmers, they are they're setting their crop prices on their crops and stuff with their mobile phone. So they're using their mobile phones in completely different ways. And I would say that I would look to developing nations if you want to talk about actual wealth building through the mobile device. It's absolutely possible. We just, again, part of our conversation is the mobile device as a consumption device and not as a production device. So that was a long answer. Somebody else has a question. Yes.
This is sort of a clarifying question, but my takeaway from this is that while mobile phones are closing that digital divide, that's not really the case, that it's just moving it. Is that...
Yeah.
That it still exists because you can't produce the same amount of content that you would produce on an actual computer?
I don't know. I don't want to say that you can produce stuff on a computer you can't produce on an iPhone, because there's probably some app developer
right.
That's made it possible. What I'm saying is that the policy message we're getting out of Washington is that if everybody's online, then suddenly the digital divide closes. It just morphs. So you're right, Nara. So then 5 minutes. Okay, great. So then the conversation becomes, okay, is the divide connectivity? Is the divide engagement, a divide between what we do with the devices? Because there is an engagement divide. And then there's this divide about who's production versus consumption. And the conversation usually stops at the first two, connectivity, engagement. And at least in the Black community, we don't have enough conversations, as far as I'm concerned, about production. So, yeah, you're right. But, no, I don't think mobile phones inherently close the gap. My cousins have smartphones. They're not starting an online business. They're updating Facebook all day. So, yeah, they've adopted the technology to make Mark Zuckerberg rich, but they're not making them, they're not, you know, and even with a smartphone, they're not necessarily using it to research. They might use GPS, there's, and when it comes to, and that would be an interesting topic as well, is what types of apps do black people buy? Because your mobile phone is only as powerful as the apps you purchase. So I'd be interested in that story as well, is what types of applications we're purchasing. So anybody else have any questions? Nobody? Well, I want to thank you for coming to my panel today.